I will call the remote hearing of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee to order. Today is February 26, 2021. This meeting is held in accordance of Rule 10.01, which was passed and allows for remote hearings. All remote hearings are recorded and live streamed by House Public Information. The clerk will take attendance by roll.
Hanson Rick,
aye.
President Wasilewicz, Amy.
Wasilewicz, present.
Heintzeman, Josh.
Present.
Aiko and Patty.
Present.
Ackland, Susan.
Ackland, present.
Backer, Jeff.
Backer, present.
Beckerfin, Jamie.
Present.
Ackland, Rob.
Present.
Fisher, Peter.
Fisher, present.
Green, Steve.
Present.
I go, Spencer.
I go, present.
Jordan, Sydney.
Jordan, present.
Keeler, Heather.
Keeler, present.
Lee, Fu.
Lee, present.
Lippert, Todd. Lippert, Todd. Lewick, Dale.
Lewick, present.
Morrison, Kelly. Morrison, Kelly. Nelson, Nathan.
Nelson, present.
Nelson, present. Tice, Tama.
Present.
Present, and a quorum is present.
The next item on the agenda is approval of the minutes from Thursday, February 25th, 2021. Representative Heintzeman, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Having reviewed the minutes, Madam Chair, I would move them.
Representative Heintzeman moves approval of the minutes for February 25th, 2021. All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Any opposed? Minutes are approved. First up on the agenda today is House File 696. Representative Beckerfin, will you move that the House File 696 first engrossment be recommended to be placed in the general register?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Beckerfin, to your bill.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. House File 696 involves certain data that the Department of Natural Resources keeps about miners. It's actually a pretty short and straightforward bill. We already heard it in my committee in Judiciary. Essentially make sure that the data that is being kept about miners, for instance, when they apply for a license or take training, miner data is kept non-public as far as access to that data. I do have someone from the DNR, Colonel Rodman Smith is here from the DNR if members have questions, but I'm actually not sure if there's any more to say about the bill itself.
Thank you, Representative Beckerfin. I don't know if folks have questions. I know Bob Meyer is here from DNR as well. Representative Heintzeman, I see your hand up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I actually have a couple of questions. The bill is pretty straightforward, but it always begs the question when one of these kinds of data protection bills comes forward, what triggered that bill being written to begin with. So I'm hoping that maybe someone from DNR could confirm that this is just preemptive, that we're not gonna see come some kind of story in the news. And then also, I'm also wondering, my notes here, what other areas would DNR be collecting data on miners? Is this the only area that would have this sensitive information, or is it just hunting licenses?
Commissioner Meyer.
Good morning, members. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources, and thank you for the question, Representative Heintzeman. This issue has been coming in front of us for the past several years. We've had several requests in the past about information related to miners that we've redacted. We haven't been sued on that, but we didn't want to share that information as well. So we're trying to codify in statute what our current practice is, protecting any information related to miners. We contain firearm safety data, off-road recreational vehicle training safety data, snowmobile, ATV, things like that. And also ICANN, through our parks programs, when people register, that information is saved. We want to be able to protect all that data, and we appreciate the support we've been receiving on this issue to date. So I hope that answers your question.
Representative Heisman?
So I'll try again. Is there any other places where DNR is collecting this kind of sensitive data other than a hunting license? And then also, has there been a loss of data?
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, or Madam Chair, I'm sorry if I wasn't explicit enough. We do have other data such as our ATV safety training records, our snowmobile safety training records, things of that nature that we collect that is non-hunting data. There has not been a breach, but we want to make sure that we protect this data to the highest degree possible going forward. And that's the intention of this bill. This bill was in front of the legislature last year as well, but due to the situations that occurred after deadline, we weren't able to move the bill forward to final passage.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That was, that was what I needed. Appreciate it. Thank you, Commissioner.
All right. Next up, I see Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Meyer, roughly, do you have an idea of like the ATVs and the gun, of how many individuals have you collected that data on? Or are we looking like for with license for guns and for hunting and so forth? Do you have like 200,000 on ATVs? Do you have that information handy?
Commissioner Meyer.
Madam Chair, Representative Backer, I do not. I can easily pull that information together for you by type. It's quite a bit, right? If you look at, you're required to have firearm safety. You can get it when take the class when you're 11. It doesn't become effective till you're 12. All of the youth that are hunting between 12 and 18 right now, that's a big number, which is great. We're really excited about that, right? But I'll get you some of that information. I'll pull together a table that shows firearm safety, ATV, snowmobile, and some of the other categories that we have just at a very granular high level and share that with the committee. I think that'd be a great idea.
Yeah, that would be appreciated. That way we know what we're working with. This is good that we're trying to be proactive instead of like Representative Heisman would say, see something in the newspaper and we have to play damage control.
All right, members, any further discussion? I'm not seeing any hands up. Representative Becker-Finn, any closing remarks here?
Yep, thank you, Madam Chair. Would appreciate members' support. I will just note that this bill is being carried by Senator Rood in the Senate and is already on second reading over there. It's really straightforward. The real question is, should this data about minors be kept non-public? And I think that's a pretty easy question to answer. Would appreciate members' support and will renew my motion.
Representative Becker-Finn renews her motion that House File 696, the first engrossment, be recommended to be placed on the general register. The clerk will take the roll on the motion.
Wasilewicz, Amy.
Wasilewicz, aye.
Wasilewicz, aye. Heitzman, Josh.
Aye.
Heitzman, aye. Akam, Patty.
Aye.
Akam, aye. Acklin, Susan.
Aye.
Acklin, aye. Backer, Jeff.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Becker-Finn, Jamie.
Aye.
Becker-Finn, aye. Eklund, Rob.
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Fisher, Peter.
Fisher, aye.
Green, Steve.
Aye.
Green, aye. I go, Spencer.
I go, aye.
I go, aye. Jordan, Sydney.
Jordan, aye.
Jordan, aye. Keeler, Heather.
Keeler, aye.
Keeler, aye. Lee, Fu.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Lippert, Todd. Lewick, Dale.
Lewick, aye.
Lewick, aye. Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison, I.
Morrison, I. Nelson, Nathan.
Nelson, I.
Nelson, I. Tice, Tama.
Aye.
Tice, I. 17 ayes and 0 noes.
The motion prevails and House File 696 is on its way to the General Register. Next up on the agenda today is House File 695. Representative Becker-Finn, will you move that House File 695 be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Finance and Policy Committee?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Becker-Finn, to your bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. This one is a little bit more complicated than the last one. So this is a bill we had before us last biennium as well, and it has to do with updating our laws related to off-road recreational vehicles and boats when people are driving those vehicles under the influence. And I will turn this over to the DNR to walk through the bill.
All right, and it looks like we have Mr. Smith here to do that. If you, Colonel Smith, if you want to go ahead and introduce yourself and begin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Colonel Rodman Smith, I'm the Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. Madam Chair, members, also, thank you, Representative Becker-Finn, for bringing this forward again this year for us. As the Representative Becker-Finn said, this was before this committee. It also made it through Chair Mariani's committee. And then, unfortunately, with the pandemic, this is one of the many, many bills last year that didn't really get much movement after that. So much of this language is the same. So what this is a DUI conformity bill. And maybe to frame this for this committee, since it is a natural resource committee, anglers have a saying, if you catch them, you clean them. And so a few years ago, unfortunately, we had a tragic incident where a young man up in Chisago area was killed by an intoxicated snowmobiler. And at that time, the legislature did some work. And on the criminal side of DUI, made all DUIs the same. And so whether you're driving a snowmobile, an ATV, a minivan, a motorcycle, a lawnmower, the criminal side is all the same. What this bill does is it makes that conformity now post-arrest, post-conviction the same too. And so it's just conforming so that all the way through this process, DUIs are treated the same no matter what they are. And so the catch-em part, I guess you could say, would be the criminal part of it. And now the clean-em side is the post-arrest, post-conviction. And that's what this bill does, is make sure that there's conformity. So it looks like a lot of change. But the reviser did a great job and decided that it was easier just to repeal a few sections and just start over rather than try to make a lot of changes. And so that's why it looks like it's a lot of work. So I'll walk through it real quick, Madam Chair, so folks have an understanding. So section one is actually has a lot of old language, because in the repealer, chapter 8491 is being repealed. And so this is the rewrite of it. And so if you look at section one, if we start on lines 1.13 to 1.14, definitions, those are kind of old, and they refer back to 169A, which is DUI statute. And so you'll see 169A a lot in this. Subdivision two on lines 1.15 to 1.9, that is old language from the repealed 8491. Same with lines 120 to 122, that is old language. When we get into lines 123 to 124, that is conformity language that talks about the suspension of driving privileges. That is new, that is conforming language. If you turn the page to 2.2 or 2.3 to 2.5, that is also conforming language. And basically what that says is the Department of Public Safety will be sending out a notice about any canceled or suspended privileges, rather than DNR sending it for wrecked vehicles and then DPS sending it for motor vehicles. They're going to get basically one-stop shopping and one part of information. 2.6 to 2.8 is also conforming language, and just talks about what public safety is going to be doing some of that work, and not DNR anymore. So just more conforming language. 2.9 to 2.14 is conforming language that deals with interlock. And so it makes again, wrecked vehicles the same as traditional motor vehicles. And then 2.15 all the way down to 2.19, that's just old language, but there is a little bit of rewrite just to make sure it's conforming with traditional motor vehicles. So that's section one. Section two is some cleanup language in chapter 84. It talks about last year in a different DUI bill, conservation officers were given the authority to write DUIs for traditional motor vehicles. And so some of the language you see that's being removed on 2.25 to 2.28 need to be repealed, because we do have that authority now and we don't need that in statute anymore. Section three is also some cleanup about fines based on this conformity. And basically since you can see on line 2.31, since 8491 has been repealed, that's been repealed are taken out of this as well. And there's just some more cleanup in this section. And then you see some new language on 3.1 to 3.4 that kind of ties back with 97A065, which I'll talk about here in a little bit later in the bill where there's some cleanup. Section 4 is basically the same as Section 1. Section 1 dealt with ATVs, off-road vehicles, and snowmobiles. Section 4 does the exact same stuff, but for watercraft, because watercraft is found in Chapter 86, where wrecked vehicles are found in Chapter 84. So in the interest of time, I'll just say ditto from Section 1, and we can move on, unless there's questions, obviously. Section 5 talks about, again, fines and bail, and this is cleanup because Chapter 86B331 was repealed. There had to be some cleanup language in where that money goes. Section 6 looks like a lot of stuff, but it really some of it is it's just cleanup. So if you look at lines 4.15 to 4.17, since we did make the changes in Section 1 with wrecked vehicles and where those fines go, it was somehow placed in Game and Fish Law many years ago. So we're taking that out of Game and Fish Law and keeping that over in Chapter 84 where it should be. 4.18 to 4.24 is language that's like 20 years old. That should have been changed probably 20 years ago. So many years ago at the turn of the century, the counties actually ran all the courts. And so when fines came in, the county had to give money to the state. Back 20 years ago, the state took over the court process. So this is just cleanup language that should have been cleaned up a long time ago. Same with lines 4.27 to 4.32 and 5.1 to 5.3. That's all that old language when the counties used to run the courts. Section 7 is getting into DUI law. The work that was done in Section 1 and Section 4 allows a number of subdivisions in 169A to be repealed. And so in the repealer, you'll see 169 1A, 1B, and 1C being repealed. And so there's just a little bit of cleanup language on 5.7 to 5.8 to address what has been done previously. And then you can also see some of that cleanup language because of those repealers on 5.25 to 5.31. And then 6.3 to 6.8 is just conforming language because of those repeals. 6.9, Section 10, that's conforming language when it comes to impaired driving. 171 is in relation to driver's license, and that's the statutes where you'll find a lot of stuff around driver's licenses. Section 11 is more conformity with interlock with driver's licenses. And then Section 12 is the revisor's instructions. Because DUI law is a little complicated, I like to think of it sometimes as a Rubik's Cube. When you move things a little bit, sometimes the revisor has to help clean things up a little bit. And they did a great job on this, and this is just allowing the revisor to make some cleanup if needed. And then Section 13 is a repealer for some of the things that are being repealed and touched on. So with that, I can stand for questions.
Thank you, Colonel Smith, for walking us through the bill. Members, any questions on the bill? Give it a minute here and see if any hands go up. Representative Heinzman.
I think maybe we should have Colonel Rodman Smith come in and do a walkthrough on all our bills. I don't know that we would have any questions. Nice job.
Thank you, Representative.
Any other questions, members? Not seeing any hands raised. So Representative Peckerfin, any closing remarks?
Appreciate member support. It's a good bill. Thank you to Colonel Smith.
All right. Representative Beckerfin renewed her motion that House File 695 be recommended to be re-referred to the Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform Finance and Policy Committee. The clerk will take the roll on the motion.
Wasilewicz, Amy.
Wasilewicz, aye.
Wasilewicz, aye. Heinzman, Josh.
Aye.
Heinzman, aye. Akom, Patty.
Aye.
Akom, aye. Acklin, Susan.
Aye.
Acklin, aye. Backer, Jeff.
Backer, aye.
Backer, aye. Beckerfin, Jamie.
Aye.
Beckerfin, aye. Acklin, Rob.
Aye.
Acklin, aye. Fisher, Peter.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Green, Steve.
Aye.
Green, aye. I go, Spencer.
I go, aye.
I go, aye. Jordan, Sydney.
Aye.
Jordan, aye. Keeler, Heather.
Keeler, aye.
Keeler, aye. Lee, Fu.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Lewick, Dale.
Lewick, aye.
Lewick, aye. Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Nelson, Nathan.
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Tice, Tama.
Tama, aye.
Tice, aye. And then it's 17 ayes and zero nays.
All right. The motion prevails and the bill is on its way to the Criminal Justice Reform, Finance, and Policy Committee. Representative Ackland, I see your hand up. Did you have a question?
I just have one question. I was just noticing something, and maybe it's too late, but I would like this clarified. So under 5.21, driving while impaired, under Section 7, driving while impaired motor vehicle, the number 7, it looks like it the person, so it says within this, let me just back up. It is a crime for any person to drive, operate, or be in physical control of any vehicle as defined in these sections, and talks about alcohol, controlled substances, et cetera, et cetera. Then number 7, the person's body contains any amount of a controlled substance listed in Schedule 1 or 2 or its metabolite other than marijuana or THC. So are they, is this excluding somebody that's under the influence of marijuana or THC?
I see Representative Beckerfin has her hand up. Representative Beckerfin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And if you'll notice that that's not the part that's being underlined or crossed out. So there are no changes in 695 that have to do with that line of the statute.
So it's not a change, but that's in there that currently that is excluded. Am I interpreting this correct? And I'm just asking, am I interpreting this correct?
Representative Beckerfin.
Yes, that I guess that is the underlying statute, and I would encourage you to talk with House Research if you have additional questions. But again, 695 doesn't make any changes here.
Madam Chair.
Representative Ackland.
Is it too late to change my vote?
Yes, it is. That's what I'm hearing.
Thank you.
All right, members, we will move on to the next bill on the agenda. And that is House File 1489. And since I don't believe Chair Hansen is back yet, I'm going to move that House File 1489 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. And we do have folks from the DNR here who are going to walk through the bill to present the bill and answer any questions. And I have Ms. Shilcox here to do that.
Ms. Shilcox, you're on mute.
How's that?
Good.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jenny Shilcox. I supervise the DNR's Land Use Programs Unit, which is housed in the Division of Ecological and Water Resources. And the Land Use Programs Unit houses the Mississippi River Corridor Critical Area Program, which is the program that is the subject of this bill. So this bill proposes to amend Minnesota Statute Section 84.027 to provide the DNR with statutory authority to conduct expedited rulemaking for changes to district boundaries that are set in the rules for the Mississippi River Corridor Critical Area. And we often refer to the Mississippi River Critical Area as the MRCA, so I'm going to use that term moving forward. For background, for members of the committee who may not be familiar with the MRCA, it is a statutorily designated corridor of land along the Mississippi River in the Twin Cities Metro, and it extends from Dayton and Ramsey in the north down to just south of Hastings. The corridor was designated by the state in 1973 as a state critical area, and it is governed by special land use development regulations that are set in rule and implemented through local plans and zoning ordinances. There are 30 cities, counties, and townships in the critical area, about 27 of which administer MRCA zoning ordinances. So the DNR completed rules for the MRCA in 2017, and these rules established districts that determine things like structure height, setbacks from the river and bluffs, and they lay out a process for local governments to request changes to the districts. However, because the districts are established in rule, it requires rulemaking to make any of those changes. And rulemaking can be a very long and complicated and costly process. So as we worked with local governments to develop the rules back in 2017, and in our ongoing work with them to implement the rules through their local plans and ordinances, they have repeatedly expressed support and a desire to have a more streamlined approach for making those district changes that is more responsive to the time that they have to operate under. So this was very important to local governments from the get-go, and we actually expressed our intention to seek expedited rulemaking for these district changes in the statement of need and reasonableness, or the SONAR for the rules. So currently, any district change that would have to go to the DNR would go through the general rulemaking process outlined in Chapter 14. By giving the DNR authority for expedited approach, we'll be able to save more money and time in responding to these requests while still ensuring a public process. So I just want to close by saying that this is a proposal really driven by local governments who administer the MRCA rules, and it will allow the DNR to be more responsive to those local district changes while still ensuring public process and compliance with the rules. So with that, I will stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Shilcox. Any member questions on the bill? I see a couple of hands, Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the testifier. Maybe I missed it. I didn't hear you mention counties as well involved in the zoning land use process. Some townships, some municipalities do that exclusively, but is the county involved in this, and do they have an input, any of the counties along that corridor?
Ms. Shilcox?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Look. Yes, there are five counties in the corridor. Of those, only two, Washington and Dakota, have MRCA ordinances. They share responsibility with the unincorporated townships, so the Denmark Township in Washington County and Ravenna and Ninninger Township. And they were all involved with the rulemaking. And they have also been involved in work groups that we've held since the rulemaking as we're implementing as local governments are updating their plans and their ordinances.
Representative Lewick?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, do you have any idea why not all the counties are involved? They just simply don't have jurisdiction over those sections of the corridor. Is that why?
That's correct. Okay. Our counties are Anoka, Hennepin, and Ramsey, and they have no zoning authority. They're fully incorporated.
Representative Green, I see your hand next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of questions for testifier or anybody who can answer them. Has there been any opposition to some of the policies that have been enacted and some of the rules that have been put in place?
Ms. Shilcox?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Green. No, actually, this process has been going very seamlessly. But I believe one community have updated their comprehensive plans to be compliant with the rules. And we started notifying cities and some townships to start amending their ordinances, and that's going very smoothly. We started in January 2020, and a couple of communities have already adopted their ordinances, and the other, many are underway, and there has been no controversy that has been brought to our attention since then.
Representative Green?
So thank you, Madam Chair. So in the past, then, for any other changes that were made by rule, have any of them been controversial at all?
Ms. Shelcox.
Could you repeat the question? I apologize. I'm not sure I'm understanding what the question
is. Well, excuse me, Madam Chair. Thank you. On your testimony, you said that the process now is made by rule. And so it has to continue to be made by rule. So has there been any controversy, any pushback in the past through this whole process?
Ms. Shelcox.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Green. There, one of the shortcomings of the initial executive order that established the corridor was that it established four districts that were very static, and there was no mechanism for changing them. So as land use changed, you know, the Metropolitan Council expanded metropolitan urban services. There were new goals for more diverse housing, transit-oriented development. A lot of those four districts just didn't apply anymore, and that was a problem going into the rulemaking. So there was a lot of concern when we went into the rulemaking in 2017 that communities be able to be, have that ability to change districts to meet their needs and other growth pressure while still meeting the intent of the regulations. So this aspect of the rules was never very controversial. It was identified as a need very early on to be able to be responsive to changes and have some mechanism so that things weren't just kind of locked in time. I'm not sure if that is answering your question, but there certainly over the years has been a lot of interest in the critical area, but this particular aspect with the districts has not been.
Representative Green?
Thank you. I see that Representative Heinzman has a question too, so I'm just gonna end with a comment instead of asking more. I see these kind of issues come forward more and more. And so what I hear from both agencies and other entities is that the process is just too hard, or it just takes too long. And so let's cut some corners. Let's kind of squeeze out the people so that they have less say and less knowledge of what's going on. These policies that we have, or these laws that we have, are designed for public input. They're not supposed to be easy. It's not supposed to be pushed through in the quickest fashion possible. I do not like this bill. I think that this could come back to bite the area, the people in the area. They will see things going through and wonder how they passed. And I hope it doesn't come back to get you in the end.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was going to ask Steve's question just in a little bit different way. I see Commissioner Myers here, and maybe Commissioner Meyer might help us better understand, I guess, two things. Again, is there opposition that has prevented this from becoming law in the past? And maybe he could help us understand why that has become controversial. And I notice that it doesn't have a companion in the Senate, so I'm wondering if there's been difficulty there. And I understand, you know, Chair Hansen's not here, so it's his bill. He might know that. And I know I'm putting Representative Jamie Becker in a spot, so maybe that's unfair. But if Bob could at least address the first question, and if Jamie Becker Finn has some background, that would be great.
It looks like Chair Hansen is back. I don't know, Chair Hansen, if you heard.
Yay. I didn't hear the question. I'm still trying to get my computers in sync here. But go ahead,
I will go ahead. Thank you. So I was just wondering, Representative Green was trying to find out if there's opposition to this language, and I think that not having a Senate companion was just raising some flags for him. And are you aware of where the pushback is coming from on this, and what the difficulty in the past has been getting this done?
Chair Hansen.
And you're on the 1489?
Yep. Yes. Yep. That's
right. Okay. So I think I talked with Senator Rood this morning. I think she's just got some jackets. So I'm not sure on it may have just not been dropped in yet. I'm not sure on this particular one, but she said that she's still trying to get some things scheduled. So, and bills dropped in. So that's just on why there may not be a Senate jacket. This was a DNR policy bill. 10 years ago, when the original Mississippi River critical area, I authored that bill. Representative Heinzman, I'm not sure if there's any other members that were here during that time. And I think it went to 9 committees at the time. And it was controversial, but it also had a 3-year, I think it was 3 or maybe 4 years of implementation. It started in the Pawlenty administration, the rulemaking, and finally we extended the rulemaking and it went into the Dayton administration and was finalized. And I worked with then Representative Abler, who's now Senator Abler, and all the kind of controversy got wrung out of it during the rulemaking. What this bill does is deals with expedited rulemaking. So I think and this is on the borders within the critical area. That wasn't really the issue in the past. This originally was an executive order by Governor Quay in the 1970s. And so we went through the statute changes in the late aughts, and then the rulemaking took a very long time. And now they want to adjust the borders of the zones within the rulemaking based on the science. I think if there are members who remember it, it's the memory of that rather than the current controversy relating to this. I have heard no controversy regarding this. I have communities that are in the critical area. And I think this is just providing for ease of updating those particular zones. So I could be wrong on with the Senate, but I think this is one that just hasn't been dropped in yet. And maybe DNR would know more on that.
I see Commissioner Meyer just came back. So Commissioner Meyer.
Madam Chair, members, again, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner. Representative Hansen did a very good job of describing where we're at. There is no known controversy. Actually, the League of Minnesota Cities or the Metro Cities do support this provision. Really, what it is, it's a streamlining effort for us to codify local government decisions through an expedited process for rulemaking. It doesn't make sense for us to go through a full-blown Chapter 14 rulemaking process to update or to codify the decision of a local unit of government. So it's really an efficiency bill. And Representative Hansen did clearly identify this project. It started off very bumpy, but through the hard work of Ms. Shilcox and her staff, we were able to reboot the process and come up with something that works, that's very supported. And now we're just trying to streamline the end product of what we have accomplished in statute. So, and we're working very hard to get the bill heard in the Senate to meet deadline and go forward from there.
Representative Heinzman.
That helps a lot. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right, members, any other questions on this bill? Don't see any hands going up. Representative Hansen, did you want to make some closing remarks? I know you just got back here. Chair Hansen, you're on mute, so we're not hearing your closing remarks there.
We're laying this one over. Are we sending it to the?
This one is going to be placed in the general register.
I would ask for your vote for support of this. I think it is a good streamlining. I'm not always for streamlining, but I think this one does provide, it eliminates redundancy that is there and would provide, it would help our local units of government.
All right, with that, Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 1489 be recommended to be placed on the General Register. The clerk will take the roll.
Hansen, Rick.
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Wasilewicz, Amy.
Wasilewicz, aye.
Wasilewicz, aye. Heintzman, Josh.
Aye.
Heintzman, aye. Acom, Patty.
Aye.
Acom, aye. Ackland, Susan.
Ackland, aye.
Ackland, aye. Backer, Jeff.
Backer, no.
Backer, no. Becker, Finn, Jamie. Becker. Ackland, Rob.
Aye.
Ackland, aye. Fisher, Peter.
Fisher, aye.
Fisher, aye. Green, Steve.
No.
Green, no. I go, Spencer.
I go, aye.
I go, aye. Jordan, Sydney.
Aye.
Jordan, aye. Keeler, Heather.
Keeler, aye.
Keeler, aye. Lee, Fu.
Lee, aye.
Lee, aye. Lippert, Todd.
Lippert, aye.
Lippert, aye. Lewick, Dale.
Lewick, aye.
Lewick, aye. Morrison, Kelly.
Morrison, aye.
Morrison, aye. Nelson, Nathan.
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Tice, Tama.
Tice, aye.
Tice, aye. That is 16 ayes and 2 nays.
All right, the motion prevails, and the bill is on its way to the next stop. Next up, we have House File 1294. Chair Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1294, and it be laid over for possible inclusion.
Chair Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. This bill relates to an issue of water and how do we protect our water and make sure that our water is not taken. This bill was introduced last year by former Representative Wagenius and had some hearings, and I want to just walk through the bill. I know there are a number of testifiers that can provide good insight on the water. A key component here is a public meeting. So when there's a large usage of water, and I know you're going to ask, where did the 216,000 gallons per day average in a 30-day period come from? That comes from 150 gallons a minute times 60 minutes times 24 hours. And that's the standard there. That's the where that dollar or that amount comes from. So when there's a large water use for that permit for consumptive use, so that doesn't mean that we as humans are consuming it. It means that it's being taken and not replenished. There would be a public meeting, and it has kind of the standard public meeting information. It also defines vintage groundwater. So this is groundwater that with a tritium concentration. So a little bit about tritium with the atomic bomb testings in the 1950s and up until the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1963, testings actually resulted in tritium being distributed in the atmosphere. So we can tell age of water by looking at the tritium concentration. And tritium has a half-life, I think, about 12.4 years. So we can measure and age water based on its tritium contact. And then it provides for sustainability. So looking at that consumptive use for groundwater, looking at recharge. So we don't want to be taking so much that we don't have the groundwater supply to meet the needs of future generations. I would also just note when we're talking about groundwater, there is a recent Supreme Court decision, Minnesota Supreme Court, looking at groundwater as drinking water. And I think that essentially indicated what we know is that groundwater can become drinking water, and we need to protect not only the quality, but the quantity so that it isn't taken or exported for a different use. So that is the bill, and I have a number of testifiers, and I know we're running out of time, so I'll stop.
All right, we do have a number of testifiers on the list, and first up is Mike Slavik. You could introduce yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Mike Slavik. I'm a Dakota County Commissioner, and this proposed language is really an important step in the right direction, providing more public involvement in large appropriations and addressing sustainability. In Dakota County, 90% of our drinking water comes from groundwater, and Dakota County is one of the largest counties for largest users of agriculture irrigation in the entire state of Minnesota. In addition, our groundwater drawdowns are predicted to occur in some of our largest, fastest growing areas in the entire county, cities such as Lakeville, Apple Valley, Invergrove Heights, and also in the southeast part of the county, we are seeing large drawdowns in our agriculture from the irrigation. This is most important to the Dakota County Board of Commissioners because only about 2 years ago, we were presented with an issue in the southern part of the county where a private entity was looking to withdraw 500 million gallons of water every single year to go in and ship it by train down to the state of Arizona for irrigation purposes. And that has really elevated the issue of the drawdowns within our county, as well as the concerns that there was not a public process for some of that to happen. Fortunately, the DNR was able to step into to other state statutes, but we are very concerned of what is happening with our groundwater within Dakota County and the state of Minnesota. And there is additionally testifiers. We do have county staff if there are questions for some county experts on that. And otherwise, thank you very much for your consideration, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Slavik. Next up on the list is Jason Mokel from the DNR. Mr. Mokel, if you can identify yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Jason Mokel, I'm a section manager within the Division of Ecological and Water Resources in the DNR. And we appreciate the testimony and the author's interest here in helping us do the best job for the state citizens of Minnesota. There are some concerns that we have with the language in the bill that we thought would be helpful to share here today. And we're very much in favor of public engagement. We do host a lot of meetings about groundwater use throughout the state and places where we have a lot of intensive water use. However, when we evaluated the threshold here of the 216,000 gallons per day in a 30-day period, and we looked back at the number of permits we've issued over the last 6 to 10 years, we're estimating that this is going to require us to host 75 public meetings on average, and as many as 100 public meetings a year. There's a substantial amount of resources that would be needed to be able to do that and do a good job of it. And I believe you have a fiscal note that would identify that our estimate is about $423,000 a year just to host these public meetings. The other thing that we wanted to mention is the vintage groundwater provision is, we see it as problematic for a few reasons. One is that the tritium signal that Representative Hansen spoke to is actually fading out. And we are in active discussions with the USGS and other geologic organizations as to what we're going to be able to use in the future to age groundwater. The signal for tritium essentially is going to be gone in another 8 to 10 years. It's one that we rely on now and use for our county geologic atlases, so we know, relatively speaking, the age of the water, and we classify that water as either modern, mixed, or pre-modern. The other thing is that we don't have age data all the way around the state. The tritium samples are fairly expensive, and we haven't even completed the atlases yet around the state. So in order for us to implement this, we're going to be operating without the information that we need to be able to evaluate permits. And I can't emphasize enough that this vintage, quote unquote, what we call pre-modern water is distributed all around the state of Minnesota. It shows up in bedrock aquifers here in the Twin Cities. It shows up in many of our quaternary aquifers around the state. So we have a challenge here with trying to implement the tritium portion of this that we would have to, for one, greatly accelerate the tritium sampling that we do And we estimated that if we could double the effort that we currently have in about 8 FTEs and $1.6 million per year, we might be able to get the tritium samples throughout the state. But even if we did that, the challenge that we're going to have is when we go out and get a tritium sample from an aquifer, we're getting one location. When you pump groundwater from aquifers, you've got a lot of interactions going on. It'd be really, really hard for us to say that there might be some mixing. And then I would just add that, you know, the fundamental principle of pumping groundwater is that you get recharge, and that recharge is coming from above. So if we are going to be held to the standard of not allowing these aquifers to have water from above recharging deeper aquifers, then effectively what we're saying is we can't pump groundwater from these deeper aquifers. It's not to say we don't understand the intention here was to protect water quality. We understand that. We just don't think that this tool, is, as it's currently crafted, is going to get us there. And then the last thing I'll just quickly add is that the adding the recharge language to sustainability, we don't think that that's really going to be clarifying. It's not a technical term. We have rules in law that define safe yield that we already use and apply to our aquifers. And there are no situations in the state of Minnesota where we are currently experiencing the issue of safe yield. Where there are places where it's of concern, we're working with appropriate local communities to manage those concerns. And then, of course, there's the sustainability component of that, which is how the pumping of groundwater is interacting with surface water features. And the recharge is critical to that, but that's recharge that's typically happening at the water table level. I know you're running short of time, so I'll end there and just see if there are any follow-up questions. Thank you.
All right, next on the list, I have Jason Halverson. You can introduce yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Madam Chair, I'm Jason Halverson, farmer from the Bonanza Valley area in central Minnesota. I would just like to say that I have many concerns with this bill and its language. We live here, we farm here, we raise our families in this area. If anyone's going to be affected by overpumping or pumping up any contaminated water, it's going to be us first. We're right here. So with that, I don't see how adding more regulation is going to benefit anyone in this area. Irrigation has a huge economic benefit to this area. So I guess I'm not in favor of this bill whatsoever. So with that, I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak on this topic that is very, very important to myself and my family. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Grant Anderson, and we'll get to member questions after testifiers. Mr. Anderson, if you can identify yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Grant Anderson. I, too, farm in the Bonanza Valley between Belgrade and Bruton, family farming operation. I have several concerns with the bill, as Mr. Meckel pointed out from the DNR. Having to go through a public meeting, as I'm aware of when we try to or when we apply for a livestock facility permit, these public meetings can become a free-for-all, if you will, from people that don't have much stake in the issue at hand. That's my big concern with the public meeting. Anybody from the state could come to testify, and the DNR already has a scientific method, if you will, to making sure that the pumping that we're going to do from the aquifer is sustainable and that we're not going to cause damage to the aquifer. They have, like I said, a scientific method that there's measured results. We have to do a pump test as part of the application process for a new irrigation permit, and those numbers are quantifiable and can be reviewed. A public meeting is going to be nothing but a free-for-all for, for anyone opposed to commercial agriculture to testify against them. And then, at the end of the day, there's still real no teeth in the matter. The DNR is going to have the authority to grant or not grant that pumping permit. So I guess regarding that public meeting, I feel that it would just add more red tape, regulation, and time that agricultural producers would have to try to fight the public to be able to operate out in greater Minnesota. So regarding the sustainability standard and the consumptive use of groundwater, like I said before, the DNR already has a set of data points in place that can be measured. So to try to put an arbitrary statement in there to say that the groundwater needs to be sustainable for the needs of future generations really doesn't have any teeth and or metrics that that can be measured. So for those reasons, I'm opposed to the bill. Thank you for allowing me to testify.
Thank you for your testimony. Next on the list, we have Lee Hansen. Mr. Hansen, if you would identify yourself for the record and then present your testimony. Mr. Hansen, you are muted. I'm not sure if you're talking. I can't see.
Now, can you hear me?
Yep.
Okay. My name is Lee Hansen. I'm the attorney for the Minnesota Irrigators Association. As the previous speakers have already all said, this issue is dealt with by the rules and the regulations of the DNR before any irrigation well, which is what we're really concerned about, can be, we can get a permit for. We have to do a monitoring well and we have to do a pumping test. And so this is just another added expense and another process that will slow down and increase the cost of obtaining irrigation for farmers. And it's going in exactly the opposite way that you were trying to do in the last bill, where you were streamlining the process. And as Jason Meckel said, this adds a lot of cost to your own agencies. And I don't think it's going to provide any more protection than you already have with the regulations that the DNR has in place. So I think not only will it add costs for the DNR, it adds significant costs for the farmers that are going to be utilizing these permits. And the Irrigators Association is happy to work with the DNR to make sure that they have the proper tools in place to evaluate these issues. And all the issues that have been raised here today are already measured by the rules and regulations and standards set by the DNR. And I think Jason Meckel made a good point of that. So that's really all I have is it's an added cost that doesn't provide any more protection or benefits than I think the state already has with the rules and regulations that are in place by the DNR.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen, for your testimony. Next up, we have Jake Wildman. If you could introduce yourself for the record and present your testimony, and then we'll get to member questions.
All right, thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jake Wildman. I am from Glenwood, Minnesota. I irrigate and farm up here in the Glenwood area, Bonanza Valley. I am the president of the Irrigator Association of Minnesota, and for the sake of time, I will just express the same concerns of this bill as the previous testimonies. I think it's more regulation, more red tape to jump through. So I don't have a lot of extra comments. I just would like to agree with the previous testimonies and express my concerns. And I just thank you for your time.
Okay, thank you for your testimony, Mr. Wildman, and we will move on to member questions. I have Representative Jordan and then Representative Lippert.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm really glad we have this public meeting to hear from everyone about proposed changes that affect all of us here in Minnesota. My question is for Mr. Meckel from the DNR, and it's regarding this fiscal note. Can you talk to me a little bit about how you're conducting public meetings in the past 12 months?
Mr. Meckel?
Madam Chair, members, Representative Jordan, we've been using WebEx most recently, and as a matter of fact, Wednesday morning, we had the most attendance we've had at a groundwater area meeting up in the Park Rapids area, the Straight River. We had over 40 members of the public, so not state agency staff, that participated in that meeting. It was an hour and a half long on WebEx, and we talked about the data and the water quality concerns and issues. We had the Department of Ag there talking about nitrogen and what they're doing with the nitrogen fertilizer management plan. We've had a meeting in East Metro for the White Bear Lake area. We've been having public meetings with contamination concerns in the East Metro as well. So we've been relying on our online platforms to connect with the public. And in fact, we've seen, interesting enough, greater participation because of it.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So then, Mr. Meckel, since it's been so successful to have these online meetings, do you think you'll continue to do online engagement for public meetings?
Mr. Meckel.
Madam Chair, Representative Jordan. You know, it's yet to be seen. There's an element of in-person meetings that we also greatly appreciate, and several of the folks here have testified that we've been meeting with them in person for a number of years, and developing those relationships is important. I don't know that the online way is going to be able to replace everything. As you all know, it adds value, but it adds complexity and difficulties as well. So I think that's an active conversation as to how do we adjust going forward, because I think there's going to be an expectation that people appreciate the ability to connect this way, but they also appreciate the ability to connect in person. So how we do that in the future once we get through this pandemic is yet to be determined.
Jordan.
Thank you. One final question, Madam Chair. Can you talk to me about how you calculated this fiscal note for the cost of meetings then, considering you don't know how you're going to be conducting meetings going forward and there might be a change in cost from online versus completely face-to-face meetings?
Mr. Meckel.
And Madam Chair and Representative Jordan, we used our past experience of in-person meetings, staff time to plan those meetings, to organize the facilities, to prepare the materials, the information that's necessary to effectively communicate what's being proposed and what our analysis of that proposal is. That actually ends up being considerably more time than the meeting itself. But we used our past experience to inform those estimates and then assumed that we'd have some sort of an in-person element. We'd need to travel to that location. Now we have staff around the state, but you know, so it's a ballpark estimate, you know, not knowing exactly where and when.
So it, Madam Chair.
Representative Jordan.
So it doesn't take into account things we've learned about online public meetings over the past year and the changes in things like printing versus emailing.
Mr. Meckel.
Madam Chair and members, we typically don't print out materials to bring to public meetings. We typically rely on some sort of a visual presentation, make that information available online. You know, if we go to online only for all of these kinds of meetings, then conceivably we would save some aspect of the travel cost. But the overwhelming majority of the cost for hosting a public meeting is all the preparation going into it.
Representative Jordan, we do have to move on to other members, so thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Lippert, and then Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'd like to thank the Chair for bringing this bill forward. So my district borders Dakota County. My house is less than a mile from Dakota County. I know farmers who farm in Dakota County, who depend on irrigation in Dakota County, and can share that folks in my area were universally alarmed that the water train issue came up, and were asking, what happens if we don't do anything to stop this, and is this going to keep happening, where we have to try to stop water from being shipped out, and you know, what kind of safeguards will be in place for us? So I just want to express that concern, that's what I'm hearing here, and I just ask that of the bill author, you know, what the question that my constituents are asking, what happens if we don't do anything right now?
Chair Hansen.
Madam Chair, I think they'll be back. I think that there will be more proposers. Maybe it won't be just Dakota County. Maybe they'll go to the Bonanza Valley. They could go other places. And the question of existing rules and statute, would they hold up in court? And so what we're talking about here is protecting all of Minnesota's groundwater. And that, I think, pay very close attention to Commissioner Slavik's testimony, because we often look at it from our district or from our personal use or for our personal business. But as state representatives, we've got to look at the whole. And so water issues, what is the price of water? As human beings, we have to have water. And we have to have good water as human beings ourselves. So what is the price for that? How do we protect that? And I understand what Mr. Mickle was saying on the decay on tritium, but if we're drawing down those top superficial aquifers into the deep wells, if we're pulling that water down, that shows there's a lot of water going out. So I'm hopeful that we can find the right amount here and the right science to make sure that we are protecting our water from losing it, both in terms of quantity or quality. And so I look forward to those ongoing discussions. I think the public hearing is critical. Because if there are large amounts of water being taken and you start to add those together, you have some consequence. This is not just a question of the me, this is a question of the we. And we've got to try and find a way. I'm open to working with people throughout the state on trying to resolve this, because I think it is something that affects all the state. And I think with Zoom and with electronic communication, as Mr. Mickle said, we can have more people involved in helping craft good protections for our citizens.
I do see Mr. Meckle's hand up. Mr. Meckle, did you want to chime in on this?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Just briefly, I want to mention, we certainly share the concerns that were illuminated when the water train proposal came forward. And we've worked with the Attorney General's office and our House attorney. And I know we're not hearing it today, but I would direct your attention to House File 1491, Companion Bill, Senate File 1110. We've proposed some language that we think gives us the additional tools that we need to both say no to export of water, but also to protect Minnesota's water supply for the future. So it was a very carefully crafted language, like I said, with the Attorney General's office and our House attorney. And, you know, if and when that bill gets heard, we'd be happy to talk some more about it.
All right. Next up, I have Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess first I want to comment when we, and this is particularly for those people that are on this committee that are not actively involved in agriculture, and have a fair understanding of the industry. I want you to just, colleagues, please take a look at the faces of those three testifiers. They mentioned that they farm for a living, and gauge how old they are. These are three young farm families. It's interesting that they've had to come forward and stand up because they certainly have concerns about this bill. And what is one of the biggest issues we have in agriculture is attracting young families. And they were very careful to kind of tiptoe around the business of public hearings. And I want to be very clear. We have seen existing process on public hearings for a new permit to irrigate turn into an inquisition. And let me repeat that again. A public inquisition directed toward the permit applicant, where young farm families were hounded, harassed, insulted, literally were concerned about their personal safety. And this wasn't coming from their friends and neighbors. This was coming from folks that were hundreds of miles away, that frankly were certainly not directly impacted by a single irrigating permit for a piece of farmland. The other comment I'll have, it's pretty clear that this legislation is so far behind the science or disconnected from the legitimate sciences. We understand how aquifers work. I think it's a concern that it needs to go back on the shelf and be brought up to date with what we are doing. So I just want to ask the bill author, this bill is intended to be laid over. Do we have your agreement that you're not going to stuff this into a bill without this going to the Agriculture Committee for a full vetting, because that's where we really deal with irrigation? And I would just really be concerned that if by laying this over, we're going to allow this to sit there and then jam it by the Ag Committee without the real expertise vetting this bill. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The DNR has the responsibility for the irrigation permits, and that's within the jurisdiction of this committee. The issue here, the issue, Representative Lewick, you know, you're looking at this through the lens of a use. There are other uses that may be a higher use for water that would take water. And so what if they take the water? What if somebody else takes the water? As representatives, we have the responsibility to represent our districts. We are all equal. We all have constituents. We all have constituents. We have young businesses. We have people who built new homes. We have people in old homes. We all are equal. The attempt here, we are going to lay it over to continue to work on it. I'd be happy to continue with work with you, to work with you, work with any member of this committee, and get input from the public as we lay it over. This is a public hearing. This is a public process. We are not moving it out today. We are going to continue to work on it, and we are going to produce a result that comes out and will be voted on by the Minnesota House.
Madam Chair, I guess I'll kind of dig through that comment and say your assumption is you're going to go straight to the House floor, but please consider that water, at least on the agriculture side, eventually manifests itself in some type of food stock for humans and animals that we may consume in the, you know, so it's very easy to make this a global issue, but there's a lot of pieces there. The second thing is there's another area over in commerce, because you're right. Water is used for a lot of other manufacturing processes. So I would suggest that not only would we be just jamming this through without really vetting it if it wouldn't be thoroughly looked at by the Agriculture Committee, but we should be looking at it in commerce too, because there's a lot of industries that do consume water to produce goods and services that we need. And again, my biggest concern here is that this bill is so far behind the science. I understand a little bit about how things relative to radioactive substances work, and I understand half-lives, and so the tritium issue is it's history, and it's going to be gone, and it'll have literally no value. So we need to do some research in that area. But again, I think that I'm still concerned. Your answer was this is ready apparently for the House floor. I would certainly disagree in that with that. But again, thank you, Madam Chair.
I will just echo what Representative Hansen said. The bill is being laid over. There is an opportunity for folks to chime in and get to a better place with the language. Chair Hansen, did you want to address?
I think using words like jamming it through, we've just spent time on this and we're laying it over for more input. And I would just encourage members to think about using words that are not accurate.
All right, next up I have Representative Fisher and then Representative Tice.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My first question would be to Mr. Meckel. Mr. Meckel, what is the highest priority for allocation of water and water allocation priorities that the state has in permitting?
Mr. Meckel?
Madam Chair and members, the highest priority in statute is domestic water consumption.
Representative Fisher?
Thank you, Mr. Meckel. So that takes priority over, you know, with that being number one, it's the number one use for water being allocated in the state. So the way I understand what Representative Hansen is trying to do, and I very much appreciate his bill being brought forward here, is to create a discussion because while we have the water train issue come up in Dakota County, there's nothing that would prevent one of the Western states saying, we need more water for our local communities. It is cheaper to go to Minnesota, buy the water, and ship it out. So tomorrow, there's nothing that would prevent one of those communities saying, we're going to apply for a permit for 500 million gallons from the Bonanza water area. And there's no open meeting process or anything else. This is for the number one use for domestic, because there's nothing in statute saying that it's domestic use for Minnesota only. So it's domestic use, could be anywhere in the country. So they could come in, make an application, and then say, we're number one use. If you have to take permits away from farmers, you're going to have to take permits away from farmers, and farmers then would lose that opportunity because they're not the number one use. They're the number three use in water statute. So I think it's very important that we have the public part hearing place in there, because there are times where farmers are going to need that because they're not the number one use in the state, domestic uses, and its domestic use could be interpreted by the courts anywhere in the country. So I want to say thank you, Representative Hansen, for bringing this forward to allow the public to have a say in it, because I think the farmers would want to have a say in that if they're finding out they're not at the top anymore. And also, more important, I appreciate the other bills you have that are coming forward to help address this issue. Thank you.
Representative Tice and then Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Probably just a few comments, but I'm really most interested in the last line of the bill. So that would be on line 2.7. When determining whether a presumptive use of groundwater is unstable, the commissioner must make a determination that the level of recharge to the aquifer impacted is significant to replenish the groundwater supply to meet the needs of future generations. Probably, Mr. Meckel, you can help me out on this one. How is that done?
Mr. Meckel?
Madam Chair and members, first of all, I need to explain that you cannot actually directly measure recharge. So the way that we understand recharge is to use the monitoring wells, the network that we have in the state of Minnesota, which is up to a 1,150 wells now, and we are able to track water level change over time. So that's how we understand whether or not the aquifers are going down, going up, or stable. When it comes to evaluating individual permits, we use groundwater science to calculate the amount of drawdown that is expected from a proposed well. And then we're able to compare that with the data that we have in the area to determine whether or not we're going to see more drawdown than the aquifer can replenish. Than is being replenished. In addition, and this is the case in the places where we have some real intensive water use, we have developed some very sophisticated water budget models in the East Metro, Little Rock Creek area. We're working on that for Dakota County. We're working on one for the Bonanza Valley and eventually the Straight River. And the whole Metro already has a groundwater model developed by the Met Council and their consultants. so that we're able to look at these issues over the long term. But these tend to be very localized situations that we have to evaluate within a mile, couple miles, 3 miles, 4 miles of proposed appropriations. Our network is the key to us being able to do that, that monitoring network.
Representative Tice.
Madam Chair, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Meckel. I guess what I'm hearing is it could just be a once in a lifetime thing. So my question is there a process to go back and check some of these and say, hey, it's not as bad as we thought it was. And to make sure that we are, you know, helping out the folks that are farming in that area. Thank you. I'm sorry, is there a process to go back and check it out?
Mr. Meckel.
Madam Chair and members, yes, about 10 years ago, we started publishing on a five-year basis a water level trends map for the state of Minnesota. And we're relying on places where we have sufficient number of years that we can actually statistically determine a trend. As you all can imagine, the water levels in our aquifers go up and down and track very much what happens with our climate. And so we have now a map. You'll see this in a report that previous legislatures require. The DNR publishes this report. It's a water availability and assessment report. And the report is due every 5 years. We update that map every 5 years. And it tells us where we have declining water levels, where they're stable, and where they're increasing. I can share that map with members to make it readily available.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, are any of our farmers still on, or have they gone back to work?
I see a few. I think they're all still here.
Okay.
At least their names are still on the screen, whether they're there or not.
Okay. I would just like one of them, and I'm not really sure who's here. Maybe, okay, I'm going to pick.
Mr. Anderson has indicated that he's here.
Okay. How about Mr. Anderson then? Just ask if what they do for their water. I'm sorry. My allergies are terrible and my brain is fogged. Could somebody just talk to me what your process is on like a yearly basis or a daily basis, please, Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Anderson?
Yes, thank you. When it comes to, I would imagine you're referring to an irrigation permit. And so the DNR, before we drill a well, the DNR issues a preliminary drill assessment. And then if we were to drill the well, then we have to submit the pumping records to the DNR. And then we're, you know, after review, they will either accept or deny our permit. And once we have a pumping permit in place, then we have to report the gallons pumped by month through that irrigation system to the DNR on a yearly basis. I don't know if that answers your question as to kind of the normal usage of the water.
Representative Tice,
this is your follow-up. I do, thank you. I just basically just want to make a comment, and I just want to thank the young men that are here representing our farming industry. I come from a farming background, and that my grandpa was a farmer, and I also have several different in-laws and nephews that farm as well. And I know it's not an easy task because there are so many different things hitting them at so many different angles that it is just, it's ironic. And I wonder too, what part does any type of farming entrepreneurship happen when we make it sound like at any moment we're going to shut their water off? I think of by Bruton, we have Redheaded Creamery. That is an awesome place to go, not only to be with friends, but also to have some great cheese. It is amazing cheese. And I think of what we as people participate with when we go to different countries, and it just feels so restrictive right now. But I think that last line just scares me half to death, that it is nothing scientific. It is a determination, and that alone just horrifies me. Thank you. Thank you for all you farmers for what you do, and thank you, Lee, for taking care of them on an association level. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I see that Commissioner Meyer is still on the line. And I read a news story, and I'd just like to confirm, because there's been a lot of questions around this, I guess, proposal that water would be shipped out of the state. So, Commissioner Meyer, my question would be, is there any scenario where DNR, under current law, would be providing permits to ship water out of the state? So what I'm driving at is, are you able to stop that under existing statute?
I'm not sure if Commissioner Meyer is available. Mr. Meckel looks like he might be able to answer the question. Mr. Meckel?
Madam Chair and members, Representative Heinzman, I think there was two ways you asked that question. So is there a way that we can stop? Yes. And that's what happened in Dakota County. However, the bill that I mentioned, 1491, and its companion in the Senate, has some language in it that we think gives us the additional tool that if the situation had been different, if the location had been different, saying no to that particular request might have been different. That's not to say, I'm not saying it would have been different, but it might have been, because every permit application has to be evaluated whether or not it meets statute and rule. So there's a lot of hypotheticals that we could play. The bill language that I'm referring to limits the transfer of water or bulk transfer or sale of water to 50 miles.
Transfer or sale.
100 miles within the state of Minnesota if you are a public water supplier. The purpose of that is to make sure that our rural water districts are able to provide water within their area of the state, particularly in the Southwest. And what this does is it stays compliant with the interstate commerce laws, where we cannot treat an applicant from out of state different than you would a Minnesota applicant.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heinzman, if you can quickly, we need to wrap up here by 10 o'clock.
Yep, I will. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I just want to quickly point out that it seems very clear. DNR has stated in news stories, and we're hearing confirmed today, that current law is providing the opportunity to stop the transport of water in the way that would cause some concern, it seems. And the other thing I wanted to point out is we have numerous folks from our friends in the Agriculture Committee testifying here today against this bill. It causes them a great amount of concern. And we do not have some company seeking to take our water in the dark of night here testifying against this language. It's our Minnesota farmers who are scared to death of this language. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Chair Hansen, any closing remarks on the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I think two things. Representative Tice, I'm glad you brought up Section 3, because the additional language actually provides a standard and clarification to existing law. And Mr. Meckel validated that they do have the monitoring to do that. Secondly, I would encourage all members and the public to go back and listen to Representative Fisher's questions and analysis, because the minority seems to have focused only on the agricultural use. And even the DNR recognizes with other language that the status quo in terms of protection for water is not sufficient, because they proposed additional language. So what we're trying to do here is provide a standard of protecting our water and have the public meetings. The public meetings are a critical component of this legislation to provide for protecting and involving the public in those decisions that affect all of our water, groundwater and drinking water. I would renew my motion to lay the bill over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 1294 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over, and unless Chair Hansen has any announcements.
Nope, you can adjourn.
All right, then we are adjourned.